It is the 1st of September, 1997, which I'm careful to say because we were interviewing in 96. And I am, we actually in Knoxville, per se, in the town of Knoxville. Yeah. We actually are in the city of Knoxville because it's almost like you're driving outside of town. Knoxville, Tennessee, and I'm in the dining area of the home of Jim Malia. I've forgotten your wife's name.
Julia.
Julia. Okay, I'm going to make a note of that. Jim was a volunteer and then later, would the administrative position then assistant chief of party?
And chief of party.
And chief of party.
Both.
Both. Okay. From 1967 through 71, starting out in forestry as a volunteer and then going on to the administrative things. I better write.
Julia.
Before I forget. So that's it for the introduction and all the time, date, and place sort of thing. And before I started the tape, I acquainted you with the general direction of where we go for however long you want to go, and I've got at least two tapes ready to go and more in reserve, plus some in the car. First thing we were wondering about is your own background, when and where you were born, your parents, who they were, what they do, the kind of influence, the family, the church, the school, whatever, on you to create the young James Malia, or do you prefer Jim?
Jim.
Okay, creating the young Jim Malia who, when you do connect with IBS, makes that connection immediate and you decide to join. So, if you could give your reflections on that.
Okay. Well, I was born in California in 1943. My father was out there during the war working in an aircraft factory. And once the war was finished and it was time to come home, we came back to the Minneapolis Twin Cities area.
He was from there?
Both my parents are from Minnesota.
Okay.
And it was, for both of them, it was home, and it was, particularly for my father, I think less so for my mother, it was important to kind of get back to where their roots were.
Mm-hmm.
My mother, and I think maybe this is part of my influence of wanderlust, my mother had always been much more adventuresome and liked to travel and
mm-hmm.
see different places and take up new adventures and so on, which she never really had as much opportunity to do until after my father died, and then that sort of opened up all kinds of possibilities for her to travel all over the country and the world and so
when
on.
When did he die?
Well, about 20 some years ago.
Oh, okay.
Long time ago.
So this is not your formative?
No. So anyway, we moved back in 45 to the Twin Cities, lived mm-hmm. in a couple different areas, and finally settled in what was at the time an agricultural area northwest of the cities, which is now a big suburb. It was at a time of transition, and there was a lot of change happening, you know, from the agricultural to industrialization and urbanization. And
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, when I go back into that area, why it's just houses and businesses and factories and so on. But that's,
yeah.
You know, this was late 40s, early 50s, was there through grade school until I was a senior, until I was a junior in high school. And the place that my father worked, he was always salesman, blue-collar worker, was doing what he needed to do in order to get by.
Mm-hmm.
My mother never really worked outside of the home. She was always very active in the church and doing good for other people. She was the one in our family that was very focused on that. My father was primarily the breadwinner.
Yeah.
He was the person that worked 5-6 days a week, whatever, and then came home and worked around the house to do whatever needed to get done in terms mm-hmm. of chores and repairs and so on. He was very, very skilled and a there was very little that he couldn't do if he wanted to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So we, most anything that ever happened around the house in terms of repair and remodeling and so on, like, he always did that. When we first moved out to the this place northwest of the cities, why it was to be as a develop a chicken farm. Apparently, well, my father had grown up on a farm, and I think that had apparently been very, very much a part of him. It was important to kind of get back to the land, so to speak. And so we moved on to an 8-acre parcel that was going to be the place where they were going to raise chickens and sell mm-hmm. eggs and kind of make their place in the world. Unfortunately, it was at a time when there was a lot of, as I said, a lot of transition, both in terms of development, but also changes in the agricultural development, such that they were too small to survive.
Yeah.
There were too many other forces that were going on in terms of urbanization to really stay there over a period of time. And so I think they actually farmed for maybe a couple of years, and they just weren't making it, so he had to get a job, was able to secure employment with John Deere as doing whatever, working warehouses and
mm-hmm.
shipping and stuff like that.
Well, he probably had a lot of skills. I mean, if you went to California during the war to work in the war industries, you picked up quite a bit.
Right. Right.
So
he was there for close to 19 years before he retired, and then died a couple of years after he retired.
Oh.
But in the time that we were there, as I say, until through my sophomore year in high school, and then the business, the factory or whatever that where my father worked, that moved to another part of the cities, getting further and further away from where we lived. And all, I have two younger brothers, all three of us went to a parochial high school, and so the idea was to move to a place where we would be close to the high school, that we could get there on our own, and it would be
mm-hmm.
also closer for my father to drive to work. So in 1959, we moved to St. Louis Park, and which is on the west suburb of Minneapolis.
Okay, I wasn't there last time. I was trying to remember
right.
some of the suburbs.
And that was home for the rest of my
mm-hmm.
father's time, and then my mother, who just died this past spring.
Mm.
And I really did not spend that much time there. I was there for a couple of years in high school. I went, once graduating from high school, I started at the University of Minnesota in the forestry program, and was there for about 3 years, and then went into the seminary, in St. Paul Seminary in St. Paul.
This is what denomination?
Catholic.
And that's the church your mother was involved in.
Right.
So it wasn't a new independent decision?
No.
Okay.
No, I mean, it was very much part and parcel. I mean, I'd been active in the, you know, as an altar boy and
uh-huh.
doing all the things that a good Catholic son does as he, as he grows up. And so was there for 3 years, finished my college, and along in that last year, realized that this was not really what I wanted to do, that there was...
Uh-huh.
I had a wanderlust and an urge to see other parts of the world and to do other things, and had become active in a variety of social issues through the seminary, through the contacts that both within and without that the seminary and life put me in contact with.
What sort of issues do you mean?
Race, and, anti-war, poverty, things of that nature. Coming out of the seminary, I filed as a conscientious objector and went through a couple of iterations of that process before I was finally given my 1W. And as part of that, I needed, you know, to find alternative service.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere along, you know, I was reading an article about something, and there was a little blurb at the end of it, a little piece about this organization called IDS that was also, could be, you know, that did things in Laos and Vietnam and was certified or whatever the proper term was for alternative service. And so that was my first contact with them.
You'd said this in the article, or did you find out later?
It was, no, it was part of, and I don't remember what the article was, but it was at the end. It wasn't in the article per se, but it was something about the goings on in Southeast Asia.
Yeah, okay.
Things that, organizations that were working there, whatever. And then one of the organizations mentioned was IDS.
It's strange that they would also, in that same publication, talk about its service as its ability to serve as alternate service.
Well, I think what it was is probably an article dealing with anti-war peace activities and so on. So it was appropriate. Yeah, well, see, that would have been probably 65, 66.
Oh, 65, 66. Okay, yeah. Okay, yeah.
Because I left the seminary in the spring of 67 and went with IDS in late summer.
So you read this while you were still in seminary?
Right.
Ah, okay, right. IMD. Yeah. Right. You may have said it, but the brain isn't functional.
So I had, then sent off for some information to, learn more about this. And was trying to decide what I was going to do. Was I going to stay in the seminary? Was I going to leave? If I was going to leave, what was I going to do? What would happen if I did not get the CO status? And all those things were kind of. And this, this was at the time that the public was just becoming aware that Vietnam was going on, that there was this war going on. The beginning of the time of the American escalation, so there's more and more publicity, and there's been a series of teach-ins. I think it was CBS News did, if I remember rightly, that were very informative to me as to some sense of what alternative perspectives on what was typically coming out of Washington as to the nobility of our cause and why we had to be doing what we were doing in Vietnam. But what eventually happened is I did make the decision I was going to leave, that I wanted to go somewhere overseas. There's a big wide world out there, and I wanted to see some of it and have some adventure. And so I wound up applying to both IVS and to Peace Corps, and was eventually accepted by both. Peace Corps was to go to Sri Lanka, and the IBS offer was to go to Laos, which I had, knew very little about Laos. But it's what they offered, so.
So you pursued.
And that it was also, I guess, one of the main impetuses to go with IBS instead of Peace Corps was the fact that I could use it for alternative service.
Ah, which Peace Corps is not.
Which Peace Corps was not. So I made whatever final decisions and closed out that part of my life. Was all during the spring of 67. And then that summer I worked at as I had for the last couple of summers, at a Boy Scout camp up in northern Minnesota. And then when that ended, was ready for heading off to begin the IBS experience, which was sometime in August.
Sometime in August of 67, the way I hear what you said is, in terms of like influences, it's not so much your father is a good role model as the brethren or supporter of the family, but as far as IVS, perhaps more your mother. But I hear other things too. I hear the possibility of religion, not just because you're leaving seminary and have to find something else to do, but as a molder of your life. I mean, obviously it meant, religion means a lot to you if you went to a seminary. Which of the two would have been the strongest, or is it even possible to categorize?
I think the time in the seminary was a real opening up, awakening for me. It was a time when I came into contact with people that were thinking about some of the bigger issues, the meaning of life and what it means to be a member of a community and service, and some of the issues that were going on at that time, race and poverty and And it was a very closed, incubative type environment, if you will.
Yeah.
That for the most part, it was not for the most part, it was a time before the church really made significant changes as far as the training of its ministers.
Mm-hmm.
So that there was minimal contact outside, so we're kind of reinforcing our own perspectives. But it was also a time to, for me anyway, to really get grounded in some new perspectives. I think prior to that, these were not things I spent a whole lot of time thinking about.
Yeah.
You know, it was life, how are you going to get a job, and what am I going to do, and, I had always enjoyed, ruralness and outdoorsness, and so I did a lot of things like that, particularly in Minnesota, canoeing and being at the lakes and stuff of that nature. So those were the kinds of things that really intrigued me. And
as opposed to snow skiing.
The larger issues of social significance and one's place in a community and society and personal responsibility and communal responsibility and so on were issues that I really did not begin to do that much thinking about until the time in the seminary.
So really, your parents, particularly your mother, and religion were obviously important foundations for your character. But more immediately, it's actually the environment of the seminary, per se, which provided the kind of hothouse for the seeds to grow.
Yeah, I think that would be accurate. And contact with a couple very significant people, mentors, if you will, mm-hmm. outside the seminary, that were a little bit older,
mm-hmm.
were involved in some of these things, and were real catalysts,
mm-hmm.
stimulants to, to provide the impetus that I needed to take some risks, take chances, not to be content with kind of doing what everybody else was doing.
And who would they have been?
There was a nun and a priest.
Ah, okay.
Again, religious.
Religious, but again, it's not
much more in a secular sense.
Sense. More of the social action rather than traditional religious focus and philosophy.
Right.
Although the one informs the other, and not to try to make too much of a dichotomy. Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah. Well, that's interesting to me. If I go around to hear this. I'm going to pause myself for this.
So anyway,
just sharing something with Jim about the how I connected what he just said with some other folks. We're back on, of course. So we've got the basic upbringing, the seminary experience, plus the wanderlust when you're out, and then the fact that you happened to come across this name IVS. And why did you choose them over Peace Corps? You may have said that, but I'm not.
The very practical reason was that I could use it as an alternative service.
Oh, I'm
for the
sorry.
CO.
Ah, duh.
There was also.
Yes, you did say that very clearly.
What was on the front pages of the paper mm-hmm. at that time was Southeast Asia. And,
right.
I was curious about what was going on there, and this would provide an opportunity to get a more firsthand look. And, at what was seemingly to become a very significant event in American history.
Even though it's Laos, not Vietnam, nonetheless.
It's a part of the world where I knew very little about, and
mm-hmm.
seemingly most other Americans knew very little about, and yet there seemed to be, it seemed like it was going to be something that was going to be very important. We were willing to send thousands and thousands of people and spend millions and millions of dollars. There must be something there that, who knows where it would all end. But so it was curiosity, it was the pragmatics of the alternative service, the opportunity to, quote, do something good for somebody.
Yeah. Let's not forget that, because
all,
I'm sure that was true.
Yeah, it was, those were the prime impetuses that headed me off in the IVS direction as opposed
mm-hmm.
to Peace Corps.
Right, right.
And coming out of the seminary, I think there was the two dominant feelings. One of wanting to do something, to be a giver, a participant, make the world a better place, whatever idealistic terms we want to put on those sentiments, as well as the chance to see another part of the world, to travel. And to
Did you recognize that Laos was so intimately connected with Vietnam? Or as intimately connected as you would might later find out to be?
I'm not sure what I knew at that point. I mean, I've since then have done an awful lot of reading, so it's it's hard to kind of sort out what I knew when. But basically, I was pretty naive. And I didn't know a whole lot. Done some reading, but it was mostly, okay, this is an opportunity to see another part of the world, to do some good, and have some adventure, and so I'm ready to go.
So you responded to their invitation.
It was a chance to have fun and to.
Were you interviewed by one of their recruiters, or
was interviewed by one? No, it was by one of the recruiters, Paul somebody or other. I can't remember his name. I think he ultimately came back. He had been a Laos volunteer and then came back with USAID. While I was in Laos, and so again the timing, I'm not exactly sure, but sometime in the spring I was accepted. So I think by the time I left the seminary, I pretty much knew what I was going to be doing.
So you were making these plans while you were still in seminary,
right? Okay. Right. So it was all kind of like I finished. It was also graduation, you know, for college, and then I knew what I was going to be doing during the summer, and then. Whenever, sometime in August, where the training was to begin.
One right after the other. What about the orientation / training?
Okay, the first, there was initial series of meetings in Washington and then up to Harper's Ferry. I think all told must have been, a week or so. It was primarily just sort of general orientation to the organization, chance to meet some of the other volunteers. There was no specific language or technical training or anything like that, but that all of that was to come later. The group that I went over with was, I think, probably the largest, at least in the time that I was there, it was the largest that was ever sent.
Oh, really?
And prior to that, I think it was also one of the largest. It was, I think there's probably 16, 20, probably around 20 of us. Something like that.
This was all for Laos, or was it
Vietnam? This was all Laos, and then Vietnam had another
whole group. Okay.
See, we were together in Washington.
Both Vietnam and Laos?
Both Vietnam and Laos, but once everybody headed off in their respective directions, we never saw each other. You know.
But it was 20 just for Laos, and then
something.
However many for Vietnam. Yeah, we're dealing in approximates.
And that was just the rural development side. And then there were also, I think, some education that were there in Washington, and then they were on it. See, at that time, IVS Laos was, there were two organizations there. The rural development, agricultural development, whatever, and then there was the educational, and they were two very, for the most part, very separate organizations that administratively, functionally had very little to do with one another. You know, get together once a while, or you'd meet people and see them in a bar somewhere, but there really wasn't a lot of contact. So we went once the initial orientation and whatever it was that went on in Washington and Harper's Ferry, once that was complete, then I say we left. Our group went to the Philippines, we flew out, spent a night in Tokyo, and then went on, landed in Manila, and went by bus to Los Baños. And because we were such a large group, we couldn't stay on the campus. They had to find rooms for us in one of the resorts that was nearby.
There's hot springs and things like that, so there's a bunch of resorts.
Right. So we all And that, for me, that was the first time I'd ever been out of the country.
What were your impressions?
It was strange. I mean, I was excited.
Uh-huh.
It was, you know, around the States I'd done, you know, a fair amount of traveling, but, you know, this was something totally different.
Uh-huh.
People not speaking English and looking different. The streets and the roads, you know, the vehicles, you know, that everything was very kind of like what I'd seen in movies. You know, this was what, quote, the third world was like, and, you know, found that, you know, to a certain extent, by that there was a lot of, at least superficially, there was a lot of truth to that. We were in the Philippines for a couple of weeks, maybe 2 or 3 weeks. We spent
doing what?
There was a variety of things. Primarily, it was revolved around agricultural development.
Uh-huh.
Spent some time at the International Rice Research Institute, getting a sense of what they were doing.
Uh-huh.
Talked about how to do development and.
Uh-huh.
Working with communities, and spent, again, a couple days. I think we went out into one of the barrios.
Uh-huh.
And spent time living with a family, you know, to have that kind of very local experience. We're there, as I say, for a couple, 3 weeks. And then once that was finished, went to back to Manila and then on to Bangkok. Because of the size of our group, and because it was at a time when the French teachers were coming back to Laos to teach, there were no seats available on flights from Bangkok to Vientiane.
Uh-huh.
And so what they had to do was to charter a bus that went by land from Bangkok to Vientiane, which was, in retrospect, I think was a unique experience, because rather than kind of picking up one place and suddenly setting down somewhere else, you know, we had the entire breadth of, you know, full day of travel. It was, we left at dawn or close thereof, and it was dark by the time we got to Vientiane. So it was, again, seeing the countryside and trying to get a sense of how it was different from where I'd been, and, you know, the villages and people walking many places,
uh-huh.
Water buffalo, the prevalence of water buffalo just kind of wandering down the road somewhere, all things that were very new and unique, although, again, similar to some of the things I'd begun to experience when I was in the Philippines. Once we got to
let me ask you about, because I'm curious about this. This is a great, I think it's a great opportunity, but I can see people who are just new to a place being really, I don't know, maybe even stressed out by that. It's such an overload of experience. They're not as comfortable as just taking a short plane ride and then landing to a place that you're going to call home in a bed. Did everyone like it as much as you seem to have?
There's a real variety.
Uh-huh, okay.
For myself, I, you know, I spend as much time out as I possibly could. You know, if I get into a new place, why, well, I'd immediately take off and
wander
around.
On this bus ride going across.
And on the bus, well, I just, in general, within the group, there were some that were, well, there were, I think there were four couples,
uh-huh.
A couple of recently married. And so there was, you know, just getting, trying to figure out who they were and with each other. So there was a lot of stress, I think, within the couples. There were like five or six of us that were single.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so a number of whom, like I said, about seven or eight, anyway.
Yeah.
But a number of them had been overseas before with Peace Corps.
And oh, really?
So it was, for them, it was very much a deja vu experience.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And for me, it was just, you know, totally new. And I was drinking it up as much as I could and, and as often as I could. So I, personally, I did not feel particularly stressed out or overwhelmed. I was just curious and was finding it difficult to get all that curiosity satiated because there wasn't enough time and, you know, the structure of having to keep moving. Once we got to Vientiane, there was additional training with in Vientiane. I began language training and was, and we were also, of course, getting introduced around to various bureaucratic groups and organizations within USAID, and just trying to get familiar. Part of the training, we did some touring around the country, and I think we broke up into groups so that some people went some couple different places, and other groups went a couple other different places. It was primarily a chance to try to help us become more familiar with the country and learn more about it and so on. Also to meet with some other volunteers, get their perspectives and insights and ideas and so on as to what was going on. The last maybe a month of the training, we went to, I have to look on a map, name is escaping me now, but we went up there to, one of the criticisms of training had always been that, you know, by having everything focused in Vientiane, people never really got out and had a good sense of what Laos, rural Laos, was really like. And so the hope was by getting us into this smaller provincial city that, you know, we would get some of that, the feel for that.
And talking to volunteers.
And talking, well, this was, there weren't any other volunteers. We went as a group then. It's the last, say, roughly month was spent in this community. And they had rented a house for us and had hired a cook, and, you know, so everything was pretty much focused there. The language training and the other kinds of training continued. And then part of that then was, you know, we spent a couple days out in a village just to have that experience.
And so how long was this whole time?
I'm trying a couple months, maybe.
A couple of months.
Again, I'm fuzzy on that, but I would
still,
say it must have been from the time, you know, including the time in the Philippines and...
You're probably, including that, okay.
Yeah, so it was probably 2 to 2.5 months, quote, training, orientation.
So anywhere from 6 weeks to 2 months in Laos with language training.
Right.
Okay, that's good as an improvement over some of the early days of IBS.
Okay, yeah, and I think that this was the first time that they had tried to do this.
Okay.
I think in large part as a result of some of the feedback and criticism that they got from prior volunteers. The group that I was with was unique in the individuality of each of the members of that group, that we were all very independent, and despite the best efforts and intentions of the IBS administrators, we very seldom did anything that we were supposed to be doing. And we tended to go off in separate directions.
Who were some of the IBS folks in charge of that? Do you remember?
Well, Pat Basler was the one that was most directly. I mean, he was the one that was involved with training.
Ah, okay.
He's way
up in Wisconsin.
Right.
I couldn't get up that far.
Tremendous, great person. He's, you know, really admired and respected.
Everything
Pat.
That everyone says, yes. But it was just too far out of the way.
He had his hands full with us, however, and at one point, you know, halfway through or so, he and Ken Ullum came up and took me out to for lunch or for get a lemonade or something, and said, you know, they would really like me to be a, kind of an informal leader and try to keep things on even keel, everybody focused in the right direction and so on. And I felt in a very awkward position because it's, you know, it was no formal position. It was, you know, they were asking me to do something that it was, you know, I would have no authority or responsibility. I would have probably, have, from their perspective, I would have responsibility, but no authority. And so I was not real keen on doing that. I said, I'll do what I can, but it's, you know, these are, you are the guys that are in charge. And we are volunteers, and you know, I'm a peer with all these other people.
Yeah, why did they choose you? Did you ever find out?
I'm not sure.
Maybe they talked to everybody. Gave the same line. I'm kidding.
They must have spoken
to you and maybe one or two other people tops to do that.
Apparently, I must have exhibited some evidence of leadership and even handedness or something. I'm not sure what all.
Yeah, and perhaps they sensed a possible willingness for you to take that kind of role.
So I don't remember what I actually did in that role other than maybe trying to get people to do a few more of the things that we were supposed to be doing at the time that we were supposed to be doing. It was not a big responsibility. I took all that seriously because I was going to do what I wanted to do. And I figured everybody else was doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
The training was there was cut short. You know, it's kind of like they finally decided you all have learned about as much as you're going to learn.
In this situation, at least.
And so the opportunity was presented, you know, we can stay here for, you know, another week or several days, or we can go back and begin to sort of wind this stuff up and get you into your assignments and get you on your way. And it was at that point that we coalesced as a group, made the decision, cleaned the house, got everything. They had a couple of trucks that came up like the next morning, or it's a specified time that these trucks are going to be here, that we have to load all the furniture on and stuff. And so, I mean, everything was done in the most efficient, expeditious, quickest way that could possibly be done. And so we were back in. It was really the only time that we worked together as a group and got something done, you know, on kind of on schedule and in accord with what the
shows a lot of people wanted to get on with the program.
Yeah, so I think that's pretty much where we were, and so got back to Vien Chan. Somewhere along the way, there had been discussion with the volunteers. The general modus operandi at that point was to, in large part, bring, quote, good people into the country as volunteers, give them some training, and then to try and find a position that was going to best meet their interests and some degree of technical ability.
Uh-huh.
That I think the idea was to work with the volunteer to carve out a position that was going to meet his or her best designs or best hopes for what they wanted
abilities and all that stuff.
Get out of the situation. So because of the experience and background, well, IBS had just started a program in forestry, working with the Lao Forestry Department, and there were two volunteers currently working in it.
Do you remember who they were?
Tom Zaharchik was one, and Ed something was the other one.
Uh-huh.
I don't remember his last name. So along the way, I'd run into them and talk about what they were doing and so on. So when it came time for my conference, why I suggested that would be something that I would be interested in doing.
Well, this is interesting because you had the forestry background already, at least the formal education.
Yeah.
But they didn't seem, from what I hear you saying now, they didn't seem to earmark you for that to begin with.
No, it was very much, I think anyway, the sense I had was it was very much the philosophy that we're not going to earmark anybody for anything.
Mm-hmm.
We want you to kind of create or define the position that's going to be most satisfying to you. And
within some sort of limits anyway, yeah.
Yeah, obviously some limits, but it was, within the realm of possibilities, kind of, what would you like to do? And so that's where I wound up. I mean, it was an opportunity to use some skills that I had, some experiences.
Uh-huh.
And there was also the program was centered in Vinh Chonh, but there was going to, at least as described, there was going to be a traveling all over the country.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It would be, rather than just be one place for 2 years, why it would be a place that I could see many different parts of the country and mm-hmm. so on. So that was appealing to me. So those two factors, why that kind of...
Did they have an experiment station or a school for forestry or anything like that?
Mm-hmm.
So the government was, what were they doing for forestry?
Not a whole lot.
Because they have so much.
Yeah, the forestry was, from a practical standpoint, was primarily managed by the Chinese.
Uh-huh.
That they ran the lumber mills and, you know, they, as an industry, forestry was managed by the Chinese as a, you know, the kind of the practical, the day-to-day having a forest manager somewhere.
Uh-huh.
You know, that was all Lao government, but the people had very little training. The brunt of the program, there was no inventory.
Mm-hmm.
There were all these trees out there, and of course the Chinese were going in and cutting as much and
as they could,
as they possibly
sure.
could,
sure.
and
sure.
selling it to the Thai.
Sure.
And so somewhere along the way, why USAID convinced them that, you know, they should begin to develop a more managed approach,
mm-hmm.
Develop ways that the benefits could accrue back to the Lao government, the Lao people, as opposed to the Chinese. And hopefully at some point that the Lao entrepreneurs and businessmen would get in on what was going on so that they would be the benefactors instead of the ones that in large part were being left out, and the Chinese were the ones that were making the money off
mm-hmm.
the timber. It was a joint project with Canadians, with the Australians, yeah, it was a Canadian, Australian, and U.S. program. And
for the forestry?
For the forestry.
So AID was coordinating with, or was it AID?
Was yeah, it was AID.
Okay, was coordinating with other agencies of other governments?
Yeah, it was I'm not sure who the agency was,
mm-hmm.
a Canadian. I'm not sure about Australia. Forget about the Australian. I think it was just Canadian. I think it was a
okay.
joint U.S.-Canadian project.
No Brits?
I don't think so. I'm trying to think of all the other non-Americans that were involved. I think we're all Canadian, French-Canadian.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Okay. There may be at some point further on down, there might have been some... I think that is true. I think there were some Australians that... were later scheduled to become involved, but that was after I left, and so I never had any
okay.
real contact with them.
So this sounds something like it was really starting at the very beginnings.
Yeah, it was. It was ground zero.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, no forestry department in an agriculture college, no real department, no experiment stations, no surveys.
They had a government office.
By surveys, I first thought of just counting of trees as a survey, but I mean even surveying probably not really very much to give an idea of generally how many hectares of this kind of forest cover versus another.
Part of the attraction of that I had for that program is that I had done forest survey work before,
state
of Minnesota, and I had you know, a fair amount of experience and what had to be done and
mm-hmm.
how to do it and all those kinds of things.
How to keep the records and keep them straight, yeah.
Right. So the project involved survey, involved the development of maps,
mm-hmm.
Cartography, the use of all this in order to bring this together in
mm-hmm.
some kind of a coherent program that would be kind of like the... At least one of the initial end goals was that there would be a map, forest map,
uh-huh.
of the Lao Forest Reserves, and that would then be able to be used to develop management plans, and that it could be, you know, a more rational approach to managing the, mm-hmm. the forests and wilds. At the same time, there would be Lao people trained to do these things, the map work, the survey work, the management work, and so on. So that was all, you know, on paper. That's what was supposed to happen. And the two IVSers had been, I'm not sure, they'd been there for, I think, less than a year.
Uh-huh.
And
these are the two forestry guys.
Two, right. Yeah. Both of which had forestry backgrounds. And not a lot, you know, they were just doing some training and gathering supplies and putting together equipment lists, and
mm-hmm.
really had not been doing a whole bunch. Or just the leadership, you know, from the USAID side was still not in place.
Mm-hmm.
It was slow in coming, and even after I joined, there was still no leadership in place. It was, again, several months. Well, finally, they hired two contractors just to come over and sort of jump start this. People that were there on the short, like 2 months to
mm-hmm.
try to get the thing going. And then the person that was eventually hired to be the project manager was a French Canadian that came several months after
under AID contract or Canadian?
I think under Canadian.
Uh-huh.
But the money, you know, who was actually.
Yeah, the money is shifted around and nobody knows.
Who
yeah.
was paying whom? That was way beyond anything that we were concerned with.
Sure.
So there was, we were the only Americans that worked with the project. There was several French Canadians, well, other than the two that were there for a couple months or so to kind of get things started.
Mm-hmm.
And there was the French Canadian, Pierre somebody or other. And then there was a Canadian cartographer that spent his time in the office primarily. And I think those were the only, at least during the time that I was involved. And I think after I left, I think there were some other people that came in.
Uh-huh.
But I'm sure I probably just met them in passing, but I never to work or know who they were.
How long were you in this?
Roughly, it would actually be less than a year, because by the time.
Really?
Oh. I thought I got awfully quiet.
Put this on pause. Okay, we're back on again.
So what?
With power restored too.
The amount of time that I was with the forestry was probably November, December,
mm-hmm.
and then by I think August of the next year, August September of the next year, when I was assistant chief of party. So mm-hmm. it was about nine.
Yeah.
8-9 months.
How much progress did you see in that? In that amount of time?
Very
little, yeah. How come? Too early? Or?
Well, what we did, we were, our side was, you know, to train people to do forest inventory.
Yeah.
So the Lao government brought in a number of their regional foresters into Vien Chan.
So they had a structure already?
There was a structure in place.
Okay.
What they did, I don't really remember. I don't think really didn't do a lot. It was just
mm-hmm.
you know, the French said you got to have a Department of Forestry, so they
set up
a Department of Forestry, and people just kind of for the most part sat around, gave mm-hmm. out permits to the Chinese to come in and log and
mm-hmm.
so on. So they brought in several people. I don't remember the numbers, half dozen, six, eight, as well as hired or brought in other people to work on the cartography side, people working on the survey side. You know, we would be doing some cross training as well.
Sure.
And we started, with the very basics of what survey is all about and how you do it and some of the tools that you need in order to do it and
mm-hmm.
why you do it and
yeah.
how it all fits together and so on. And then went out and started doing some survey in the area, probably within 100 kilometers or so of Vien Chan.
This actually sounds like a lot. I mean, you said very little happened.
Well,
but this sounds like a lot.
There was, it's all kind of relative.
Yeah.
In terms of what was envisioned and what was supposed to happen, my there wasn't, and what eventually happened, but there wasn't that much.
So it never really did blossom?
It never blossomed. No. Okay. It was a great time, as far as me personally is concerned. You know, the guys that I was working with were a wonderful group of individuals. It was, you know, my language skills were still very rudimentary, but you know, it was an opportunity to really work on Lao. They knew a little bit of English, you know, I knew a little bit of Lao, you know, so constantly were, you know, whatever language would work best at the time, like we'd fall into that.
Probably lots of hand gestures, too.
And lots of hand gestures. There were some of the initial trips were, you know, just day trips out and then back into Vientiane. There were a couple longer trips where we went out and stayed in villages or towns for a week at a time, or close to a week at a time. And then the last, kind of the last of the initial phase was we were getting, one of the realities that we had to deal with was the war. That security was always an issue. There were there were places that we wanted to go into, and the Lao would say, no, that's not secure. They did not want to go there. You know, they, rightly or wrongly, they had a good sense, or seemed to have a good sense of where to go and where not to go.
They didn't want to go there, or they didn't want you to go there?
They did not want to go there.
They did not want to go there. Okay.
So the last kind of like big push that we did was an effort into an area where, I don't know if Americans couldn't go, or why it was that we, or if we had reached a stage where, well, I know what it was. It was an area where the transportation was very poor in terms of roads, and so we had to use a lot of helicopters that they'd get dropped down here, and they'd spend a couple days, and then when they had done that area, then we'd pick up and move over to another village. And because of the three Americans that were working, you know, the three volunteers, I was the one that spoke
Lao. You and the two other
two other IBSers. I spoke Lao the best.
These were the original two, not two new ones.
Right.
Okay.
There was never other than just the three of us.
Oh, that's right. There was three, not four. Okay.
Okay. So because I spoke Lao the best, my job was to coordinate things from the helicopter. That.
Oh.
They had, we had USAID or Air America helicopter, and of course the pilots didn't speak Lao.
No.
And we needed to be in communication with the people on the ground, you know, to, are you done, where do we go next, you know, we're picking you up in this clearing over there, do you, you know, have you got it spotted on your map, kind of
thing.
Yeah,
if there's not a Lao who can speak English well, then...
Right, and there wasn't.
Yeah.
So, we did... Let's say that last week or a couple weeks or whatever it was, when I just kind of jump in from place to place with the helicopters and wrapping up the survey in that particular area. And again, that was a unique experience because it was one of the other times when we'd been out, although we were walking through villages, we were always staying in towns. And this time we were actually staying out in the village, at least part of the time, and then would go from place to place. So the last day we were there, in this kind of the main headquarter village, if you will, they put on a big celebration for us, gave us a bossy, and you know, food and the whole works.
Even though they probably were kind of struck.
Yeah,
what the heck are you guys doing
here
anyway?
Why are these people here? You know, what's going on?
Counting trees?
And so, you know, it was a great experience. And then, so that was winding down. This was getting towards the first year that I was there. And I was getting ready to go on vacation. So I can't remember exactly the timing on this, but I left first part of August and was gone for close to...
This would have been 68.
Would have been 68.
Yeah.
So So I've been gone for roughly, I've been in country for roughly a year, maybe a little bit less. And so I went off on, I think there was something we had, the tickets that we brought over that got us there, because we didn't fly to Vientiane, we still had the ticket, but it had to be used within a year.
Or it lapses, yes, I know that.
So that was, as I remember, I think that was the main motivator to get out at the time.
Get a trip to Bangkok. Uh-huh.
And so I took off for around a month or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Bangkok and Penang and Singapore, and then my cousin and her husband were in the Peace Corps in India, so I spent a couple of weeks in India.
Ooh.
And then came back. So some
of course that ticket didn't do all of that.
That ticket didn't do all that, no. It just kind of
that was the first little nudge,
got the first step.
Yeah.
So it's either before or after I got back. I don't remember.
I was asked
if I would be willing to come on staff as a assistant chief of party or assistant director. We kept debating as to what names we should call ourselves.
I like chief of party, because then you could say a cop.
Right.
And then someone gets to be the director, or the cop.
The cop, right. So I said yes, that I would. And
I'm going to ask you, this is the second time you've been asked to do a leadership thing. Once during training and now again. And you didn't know before, but what about this time? Any reason why they asked you to go into this position that you know of?
Oh, I don't know. I guess, again, I think they perceived that I was reasonably responsible and could get things done with other people and could take care of myself as well as take care of other people and do so in a reasonably responsible way.
And then you think they were able to observe this during the time when you were working the forestry?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I was in Vientiane. I mean, the headquarters or the base of operation was always in Vientiane. So
correct,
I lived around there and, had a little bit more contact with the staff and some of the other volunteers that were out there.
Okay, all right.
So, I guess...
And I was thinking also, I wanted to hesitate to see if you were complete with that thought. Was it because your forestry thing was kind of winding down too? That they might have been looking for something for you?
No, I don't think that. At the time, it really wasn't winding down. I mean, it was still kind of on a slow go ahead, but...
So you could have stayed there and...
Could have stayed.
Done last year and...
Done more. Done. The two volunteers, they finished out their tours. The one... Continued to work with them for, I don't know, another year or something like that before he finally, as a youth aide. That was Tom Zaharchik.
Zaharchik, okay.
And Ed, I'm not sure, I think he, when his tour was up, I think he just left.
Okay.
He's kind of a faceless person in some respects. So IVS at that time was going through another internal organization of trying to best figure out how to administer the volunteers, and so they come up with a staffing structure that would have, or organizational structure that would have, the core staff in Vientiane, and that there would be regional staff, one in the north and one in the south. And
so one in Lan Prabang maybe, one in Savannakhet and things like that.
Or Paksay.
Paksay, right.
Kind of.
Okay.
So I was charted for the Paksay office. And in general, the regional director's responsibilities would just be there to support and keep in contact with all the people in the southern region or northern region or central region.
So there would be a number of ACOP people.
Yeah, there were. I mean, there were at least two regional, and then there was somebody for agriculture and somebody for community development.
Right.
So sure. I mean, it never worked out, so I'm not sure what it was supposed to be. But anyway, I was supposed to have the southern region, and I went. So those were my volunteers. And
no matter what their job.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And again, this was all the rural side. It was not, had nothing to do with education.
So
the organization still had not merged.
Okay, so all the volunteers,
all of,
in not the, in education, in
right,
the South.
Right.
So there would be education volunteers in the South.
Right.
But you didn't deal with them.
Yeah.
Okay. All
right.
Just trying to keep these lines separate.
It was confusing.
Mm-hmm.
That was to change. So the plan was that I would move to Pac Se and set up residence and, you know, some mode of operation and keep in contact with those people. And I think I made a couple trips there and started going around getting acquainted with the USAID people and the Lao government people and the volunteers and so on and so forth.
Sure.
And then something, it didn't work. I mean, either somebody new came on staff, and so we decided to kind of reshuffle again, or kind of, I don't exactly.
Fennell. Lauren Fennell. I'm sorry to interrupt,
okay,
but
okay.
I was trying to remember a name earlier.
Right.
And I'm going to pause this. Put it back on again. There
may have been another time on who was when, where, and so on. Little fuzzy on for.
Well, I was just struck that I finally remembered his name.
Okay.
And I was sitting earlier trying to pull that name out and couldn't do it. And I knew it was an L, but it wasn't the last name, it was the first name.
Well, and his description of his job was, you know, was very accurate. I mean, he was the first one to, at least from a financial standpoint, to bring the two organizations together.
Yeah, to create one director rather than have...